have to admit, I went way overboard in the length of the title, and it's okay. It was actually percolation induced. I don't know why I did this, but maybe it's reflective of sort of the topics I would like to touch upon, because I do see there are a lot of connections between my research and what sort of should be going on in this Random Shapes workshop. I will talk basically about the things you can do when you do seismic imaging, where you basically try to make an image of the Earth's subsurface, and then subsequently you try to find the important events in your image of the subsurface and try to characterize them, and then also try to understand the physics that is perhaps responsible for the type of features you would see in the Earth. So it's quite an ambitious research program, but I think you have to address all of those if you want to sort of increase your understanding of what goes on in the Earth. This is joint work with Yves Bernabé and Chris Tolk and my graduate students listed below.
Are you going to explain what all the words mean in this
title? I will. and that will be a talk by itself. That's why I need a talk, right? So what I'm interested in is, first of all, develop new techniques that obtain higher quality images. We always want more and higher quality. That means better resolution of whatever happens in the subsurface, right? We have incomplete data, right? There's nothing we can do about it. So, and in a way, this boils down to imaging of shapes. And then subsequently, we would like to characterize these shapes. And what I'm interested in is to assign sort of a sense waves reflect at wherever the derivative in the elastic properties is singular, that is, the derivative blows up. I want to sort of classify different types of transitions by what you could call singularity orders. I want to be able to discern, for instance, between a zero-order step function in the elastic properties versus something that's the integral or a fractional integral of that.
So the singularities are fractures in the surface?
The singularities are basically changes, rapid changes, in the elastic properties, which are the coefficients of a wave equation. So it's the density of mass and the elastic moduli. Okay, so they are the physical properties.
So the coefficients of the wave equation.
Correct.
In the Earth.
In the Earth, right? And okay, whenever the coefficients contain singularities, you reflect, okay. Right? Okay, so then you also would like to understand what are the physical processes that could be responsible for these things. It's naive to think I rock A, rock B in welded contact, right? Is there something else going on? Now, I don't know whether I can make it through all these things, but I'm going to try. Promise, I will be mathematical in certain cases, but some cases I will be a little bit more loose. So let's first start to talk a little bit about what does the seismic acquisition do and what are we doing when we do imaging. So what we typically have is an active source, could be an earthquake actually, it would be passive, sends waves down in the Earth, they reflect at the singularities, at the points where the coefficients of the wave equation change rapidly on the length scale of the wavelength of the wave. And then we detect these bounced waves at the surface by a series of geophones, and these geophones measure what they call these traces, and here you see all these wavefronts coming in. You get a gazillion of these. I mean, if you thought that the data volumes of the previous talk were large, that's peanuts compared to this watch. Okay, so you have typically millions and millions of these, and what the process of seismic imaging entails is to map this energy to the reflectors in the subsurface. That's basically one of the big problems.
You mean there's a lot more money in oil right now than water?
I leave that to you, right? So, okay. So what you can do now is you can make an image of the subsurface. And this is an image of the first, say, 7 kilometers of the subsurface. So what does strike you is that you have this sort of laminated structure, which is the sediments, and we have basically, it's what you would call layering. You can see that also when you see an outcrop of sedimentary rock, you see that sort of stuff going on. So you can see that you have nicely lateral continuous things, but there are also sort of faults and other stuff going on. But basically, these things are imprints of the singularities in the Earth. So what you do during imaging, you create an image of the subsurface and the singularities, and you would like to get as high resolution as possible. And of course, there's all sorts of clutter going on, noise, and you want to be robust for that. And then, in addition, there is incomplete data. Okay. So, another thing that's interesting, this is another image, is that we typically do this seismic exploration before we drill a well log, and this is when you drill a well log. That means you drill a hole into the Earth, and you measure at a scale centimeters, rather than, I should have mentioned this, This sort of wiggly stuff is on a length scale of 10, 25 meters. These guys are sub-centimeter, and they're very fractal-like. So you have to deal with something that is very complex, but still there is some overlaying structure, otherwise you won't be in business, right? So, and we're able to image that structure, otherwise you wouldn't be in business either, right? So what are the first sort of leading order observations you can make? Well, first of all, the Earth is highly heterogeneous, multi-scale, and these reflectors, they appear intermittently. It's not, the Earth is not white noise, right? There's some structure in it. That's one. Secondly, the seismic data contains wavefronts. We detect wavefronts. They are bandwidth limited because the physics doesn't allow us to send any arbitrary frequency into the Earth. But they contain, you know, the important wavefronts that contain information on the structure of the Earth. And it's up to me to image that and to subsequently obtain information. Another thing which is very important is that there is sort of this layer structure. And really what it means, I think, is that things have tend to have a different smoothness. When you hit a reflector perpendicular, you have things that rapidly vary, whereas if you're going in the along direction, things are smoother. So there's a difference in smoothness that sort of delineates the structure. The waveforms really contain coarse-scale information, and what we would like to get is more fine structure. We would like to know what do these layers that reflect waves look like, right? Because that's in the end that geologists and geophysicists are going to use when they make decisions to drill for oil or something, right? And well, I have to say, everything lists by virtue that there are singularities, otherwise there wouldn't be any waves reflecting after all. Okay, so two important questions: how can we obtain information on this fine structure, and how is it related to the underlying physics? And hopefully I will be able to get to that.
Might I ask, are you also looking at the phase of the reflected wave or just the amplitude?
It's the phase. You get the whole wave training, mm-hmm. right? So, and actually the phase contains tons of information.
Yeah.
You could actually only image zero crossings. You get still an image, but then the amplitudes are incorrect, and that's information I will need. I need more than that. So part of my talk will be about getting the amplitudes right. Okay. Now, this is just because there is a nugget on the website, and I thought I should advertise this for a second. So I mentioned incomplete data. This is a plug for a student who will talk at the AMS workshop this summer. But this is something we can do in my group to handle incomplete data, but it will have ties into what I will continue to say. So this is the seismic data volume. Think of it a cube which you folded open. So this is from one side, this is from the other side, and this is a time slice. That is a slice horizontally, and this is a slice vertically. So you see these wavefronts coming in. This is what the data would be like. Unfortunately, we don't have all the data. We typically miss tons of it. And this is an example where we threw away 80% of the source and receiver positions. So that gives you a very sparsely sampled data set. But we were smart. That is, we put this missing data, we do that randomly. And this is really motivated by a field of compressive sampling, which tells you that you should never regularly undersample. That's very important also for you. And that's the biggest misunderstanding, I think, in the field of sampling. Don't regular sample, do it random. Then you can use sparsity, that is L1 minimization, on the representation that sparsely represent wave fields, which are curvelets, which I will come to in a second. And then you can actually recover this data. I mean, it's not perfect, but it's pretty darn good. And that just exploits the fact that there is higher dimensional structure in these wave fields. And if you use a transform that detects the wavefront set, then actually you can recover it by running a nonlinear program of the following type, where you basically say that my incomplete data is given by an inverse transform, that's CH, followed by an operator that picks where there, puts zeros where there's no data and ones where there's data. And multiplies by ones, I should say. And then there's noise, and then you just solve an L1 problem where you try to find the sparsest set of curvature coefficients in an L1 norm that minimize, that fit the data within some L2 norm where epsilon is noise dependent.
What are curvelets?
So curvelet is this matrix C. I will get to that in a second. Okay. That is a linear operator that contains on its rows things that can be interpreted as little plane waves, multi-scale, and they yield arguably the best compression rates for this sort of data, hence that explains the recovery. So we are able to do recovery, and it works because we exploit high-dimensional geometry. And I will talk a little bit more about that in a second. What's really crucial in this is the randomness of the sampling. This is not, I think, really the topic of this workshop, but it's a plug to other stuff that has been going on at IPAM and will be going on next week, I guess, and this summer, and all over the place, I guess. So it uses ideas of what's called compressive sampling. And actually what's cool about this, we do this on steroids. The size of the problem I just showed you has something like 2 to the power 30 unknowns. So we can't claim we solve any L1 thing, but we do something that's close enough to do the job. And that's really a lot of the challenges I have in my group that we work with things actually on.
How long has compressive sampling been used in this field?
Well, it's very interesting. Compressive sampling was already done in exploration seismology way before it was invented by the compressive sampling community. So there are papers dating back down more than 10 years where they do L1 or Fourier in the seismic community. But they never really understood the randomness, that's important, mixing, all these UUPs of Candes and that stuff they never understood. But they had already some good intuition about it. So it's not...
For
well, this is, I'm talking about now, 96.
So they were doing uniform sampling in Fourier space?
Non-uniform, they did non-uniform sampling in time for a signal that is sparse in Fourier. Okay, so what's the problem if you want to do these things? You want to find a compressible representation, and for that you will need to be multi-scale and multi-directional because you have wavefronts that live on different scales and different angles. You have really things in a mathematical sense that are intermittent with regard to the regularity. You have weird things. You have in wave fields, you have caustics or conical points. You have a pinch out where reflectors merge. You have all sorts of stuff going on. You also would like to have some invariance under the operators because we are in the business of doing an inverse problem. And so that's what you need. So what do I mean with this? If you see here in synthetic data, so this is again what these geophones would measure. So you see these wavefronts coming in. They're smooth along an oscillatory cross. So that's something you would definitely want to exploit. And that happens in higher dimensions as well, not only in 2, but in 3. So you really want to use some sort of a decomposition where the essential support aligns itself with the wavefront giving a large inner product. If you make an angle, a smaller inner product. So you need some construction that does that. So one very successful construction is called curvelets. It's worked by Emil Candes and Donahoe and Tamanan Ying. There are other people, Jean-Luc Stark has worked on it. There are several people. And what it really means is you have some sort of very smart decomposition of the Fourier plane where these curvelets live in these strictly localized wedges. So this is the zero frequency, and you move out like this. So this is a two-dimensional Fourier plane. And these are the associated curvelets, which are basically rapid decay. They're oscillatory in one direction and smooth in another direction. And the curvelet transforms nothing else than a decomposition of the signal with respect to tons of these guys. Right, so that's what these curvelets are. And they're really a collection of wave packets. I took this from a slide from Demonet, which are indexed by a scale, by positions, and by an angle.
Okay, so these are all certainly overcomplete.
It's certainly redundant, but redundancy is good. It's a misguided effort, I think, for people to try to get things orthogonal.
No, but it's not orthogonality is not the issue. It's overcompleteness. How do you project?
So what you do is you take the forward transform. But you don't really take a forward transform, you solve an L1 problem. So you try to find the sparsest set of curvelet coefficients that explain your data, and then you get it right. That's how you step over the hurdle of your overcompleteness.
Yeah.
You can make this overcompleteness even worse than by throwing away data. It becomes even more rectangular matrix you invert. But apparently it's very stable for that because the decay rate of the sort of coefficients goes down so quickly, and hence L1 brings that out. Okay, I'm going to skip this because this is an extensive literature on this. So what's important, though, is a theorem which tells that the nonlinear approximation rate of these guys for functions that are piecewise C2 with singularities on piecewise C2 curves decay near optimal, right? And that's, okay, that's an asymptotic argument for discrete world. It doesn't mean necessarily anything, but it gives you at least a theoretical idea that this is the right thing to do whenever you have wave. This is what one of these guys looked like in 3D. So you see the thing is smooth, except for the direction where the oscillations come in a second. So now you see the oscillations coming in, and you do a decomposition with respect to tons of these guys. And that exploits the higher dimensional structure of wave fields. Now, this is an example of some image. You can see it's pretty noisy. This is what you can get back with curvelet thresholding. So now you don't even do L1. You just keep 1% of the coefficients. You can see you pick out basically all the coherent structures. It's quite incredible that it does this without any work. Okay, so curvelets really are the right thing to do because they detect the waveform set and they are sort of invariant under wave propagation. I haven't had time to spend a lot on that, but that is important for the sort of stuff we do. And I want to spend the next 5 or 10 minutes on basically finding a way to do this imaging while preserving the amplitudes using some of these invariance properties.
Just before you said all the coherent structures. So what does that mean?
What I mean is that you get, if you were to give this to a geologist, he would be darn happy.
That's all he would want?
Yeah.
Right, so curvelets have 4 parameters, so.
They have 2 positions, if you're 2D,
right.
Then they have an angle and a scale.
What about the squishy?
They have, I should have said that, they have a particular aspect ratio, length to width, L to L square.
So that's a fifth.
So, well, no, that's,
no,
in the,
no.
That's built in the construction. So if you go to find a scale, then automatically the thing rescales anisotropically.
Parabolic scaling.
Yeah. The parabolic scaling equivalent. It's Stein's second dyadic partitioning or something. But that's a little bit out of my league. Okay. So now I go to imaging. Now this work doesn't stand by itself. There's lots of people in my field, but also mathematicians like Tim Crowder, Bill Symes, have looked at the process, which is called is migration, and migration is nothing else than solving an inverse scattering problem to try to take this data we collect at the surface and make an image. Okay, and it's a very rich topic mathematically, and I will touch on some hard results we have there just to give you a flavor that actually there is some mathematics that goes on. Now, what's the forward problem? This is a difficult one, right? Because what you have, your forward mapping is from the coefficients in a PDE to your data, and then given the data, you want to get those coefficients out. Now, that's almost hopeless, although with current bigger computers and maybe smart guys, we will be able to actually start solving this one on more larger scale. What we do, though, mostly in this day and age, we linearize the system, and of course we discretize it so we have something in the computer. But you can associate, sort of what you do is you run sort of an adjoint state method on this PDE. That's what you're doing. And what you try to do is, given your data, try to get those coefficients C, at least the perturbations in them. That's what you try to do. And so what you do is you minimize this nonlinear functional and you linearize it. And what then happens is that your data, as a function of your source, receiver, and time, is given by the perturbation in the medium. And then you apply a linearized scattering operator, which is a Born approximated scattering operator, to it. And then there's noise. Now, this operator is basically near unitary. You can actually argue that it's Gram matrix. So now let's jump to discretization. So now I'm going to talk about matrices. It's matrix free. These matrices are humongous. One evaluation in practice can take up to a month in a cluster. So these guys are big. But in principle, you can prove that K transpose K is so-called pseudo-local. That means if you apply to M, it preserves the singularity. Right? It may filter them dependent on the position and the angle, and that's what I will be talking about. Now, I'm going to try to invert this operator on the shoestring, namely trying to not do too many evaluations of this K transpose. Actually, only one. Okay, so that's sort of what I call amplitude recovery. And there's a little bit technical, so these are 2 technical slides now. So we need to make that operator zero order, because this is, for those of you who have heard of this, but if you don't think of it, it's a pseudo-differential operator. We want to make it of zero order. Mm-hmm. What is a pseudo-differential operator? It's something that filters your data non-stationary. That means it applies a frequency-dependent filter dependent on space, right? So, and on dip. And that's, so it's a non-stationary convolution operator, if you wish. Mm-hmm. You want to make that guy zero order so that it's sort of nice and tame. You can do that by sort of preconditioning your operator, by introducing these half integrals or half derivatives, whatever. Now, what's important is this. If you take the medium that defines these operators, that is the background model with respect to which you linearize, you take that smooth, then you know that the symbol is smooth. Okay, that's one. Then you also know that you can approximate your symbol by only looking at the values of the symbol. So think of the symbol as your your space spatial frequency filter, right? Multiplicative. And now we're going to look at these x mu and zeta mu's, which are nothing else than the midpoints of these curvets. So this is the midpoint in frequency plane, and also a midpoint in the space domain. And then you can bound this error, and that error decays with the scale. This absolute value of mu is the scale. So if the scale goes to finer and finer, this approximation gets better and better in the L2 sense. Okay, so that means that we should have a pathway to
the spatial regularity of A.
We use the spatial and spatial frequency regularity. So we use smoothness in both space and in frequency. And that's actually how we are able to find the diagonal approximation of this operator in the curvature domain. Because what we want to do is we want to basically replace the action of this pseudo-differential operator by taking a curvature transform, applying a diagonal, and taking an inverse curvature transform. And in order to find the diagonal, we assume or we make use of the fact that the symbol is smooth. It's very common that people want symbols to be smooth, because if they're not smooth, you open a can of worms, although people are working on it.
But I'm associating that A with the unknown C in your original wave equation?
Well, we don't. We associate...
And C has discontinuities.
No, no. What I'm talking about now are discontinuities. Since we did the linearization, right?
Uh-huh.
So you split off the singularities. That's the thing we try to solve in the inverse problem. But then we have a thing where we linearize with respect to. That is assumed to be smooth. Okay. Because that defines the operator. Okay, so it's not the same type of smoothness. Okay, I'm spending too much time on this. But the important thing is that we can actually approximate this operator and we have a result that tells us how accurate we do this. So we can bound it. That means that we can actually say that we can replace the action of that Grum operator on a curvelet by just taking a diagonal operator, and that brings us in the framework of L1 recovery, and we can just invert for that diagonal. So that's basically what it is. So maybe I should skip a little bit. But you know, in a way, what we can do is you can now represent the data by a weighted curve transform. This A is nothing else than a weighted inverse curve transform weighted by the diagonal. And we solve an L1 minimization problem, but a little bit more complicated because we have these artifacts. One thing that's very important, and I think Stan Osher will certainly collaborate that with me, is when you do wavelet-like of estimations, you have typically these artifacts where you detect wavelets which shouldn't be there. Mm-hmm. So people want to impose an additional penalty term, and we do that through an anisotropic diffusion type where we set P equals 2, where we penalize the directions along the reflectors but not across. All right? So that's what we do in order to improve the thing. So we have something that takes derivatives in the two directions, and I don't want to go into this detail, but that's an additional trick, an anisotropic diffusion that helps us solve this problem. So this is an example. It's a little bit dark how it's projected. This is a synthetic, but this is very difficult. This is like the state-of-the-art industry benchmark people give you. This is a salt structure with a very high velocity, a lot of diffraction of energy down here. This is relevant for people in the Gulf of Mexico trying to find oil reservoirs under the salt. So they're interested in what goes on over here. I added like tons of noise to the data, so you see the imprint of clutter. And what we do now with our technique, and fortunately it doesn't project as I wanted it, but hopefully you can agree with me that this is a much improved version of the previous one, where not only the noise is removed, but also the amplitude degradation of, in particular, the reflectors under the salt has been improved quite significantly. This is just by using the fact that we can diagonalize the operator that does this blurring, and in addition to this, we use sparsity of this transform on the type of objects we try to recover.
Could you say something about the staircasing?
Yeah. That's just because these guys can't afford to make too big models. It's a bad discretization. That's all, right? Mind you, this example here runs already something like 10 hours to do one K transpose K on a cluster of 100 CPUs. Right? So if you were to make the model bigger, then things just get even out of reach in at universities on a moderate side cluster.
Excuse me, this is for 3D?
No, this is all 2D, this is just a 2D. 3D is out of reach for us. Right, then you would take a month to do one matrix vector. Right, so I can't do that. Okay, so this is this was the original reflectivity. So you see that we did a pretty good thing. Now, this is what you, that we tricked a little bit because we used in the previous example the same operator to model the data and to image it. Now we're going to use an operator that's not linearized. That means that there is all sorts of internal reflections and difficulties going on. And now you can see that the image applying k-transpose to the data gives you all sorts of artifacts. And look, all the amplitudes below here have been unfortunately lost. But with our method, we can still certainly image the bottom of the salt much better, as you can see. And some of these reflectors are popping up. But this is really, this is difficult. I mean, this is where the action is, at least in research in this field. And I think we are on the right track to make this work. So just to wrap this up, I think these curvelets are very good in doing what you could call an imaging that preserves the singularities, and we just use the sparsity of these transforms and their invariants to solve this problem. What is a little bit naive in these things is that, as you could see, that model only contained jump discontinuities. And I want to spend the rest of the time of this talk to talk a little bit more about the fine structure of these transitions in the Earth that give rise to reflections. Right? It's the classical thing everybody learned at high school, that you had a zero-order jump in the properties that, for instance, led to refraction of light, is a very naive, very narrow-minded, if you wish, description of what really could go on. It's a richer family of different types of transitions that could give rise to reflections. And I'm switching gears now, where I say I take an image and now I would like to understand what is in this image. And the final question then is, why is it in the image, right? So what we really want to do is overlay the images with something that would give us information on how sharp are these reflectors. Mathematically, what's their local Hölder regularity, if you wish, right? So that's sort of what we try to do. So typically, as I said, if you're an exploration seismology, you think of a reflector as a jump. If you're a global seismologist, you think in terms of first order singularity. We think in terms of a whole spectrum of different profiles, if you wish, when you go through the reflector, that delineate how sharp or not sharp are they, and can we get that information from the associated waveforms, which are sort of related through a convolutional model. We can see that there's a distinct difference between the waveforms associated with these guys. And that's what we try to get at. It's difficult, though, because this is broadband. Here you have all the scales, and here you have only a single band. And there's, of course, ledger varying structure. Things are not so easy. And we have been trying and still trying to work on it. So we have a parametrization now where we think of a profile through the Earth as a superposition of these algebraic onset functions that are defined by a scale exponent, and we are after that scale exponent, because that would delineate how sharp these reflectors are, and that gives us information on what goes on. And we do that by basically having what you could call a detection estimation technique, so this is a trace idealized where we find detected different events through a multi-scale technique that is based on the complex wavelet transform. We try to find the maxima that point to the points where the significant information is, and then we window it out, and subsequently we apply a nonlinear inversion to get to that exponent from those waveforms.
How do you choose the alpha ends?
The alphas we don't. The alpha is the unknown. So we try to estimate the alpha. So we get the waveforms.
You have many alpha n's in the sum.
Oh, how many alpha n's?
So you pick a certain number and then try to optimize the alpha n's?
Well, what we do is we basically find, you have some, now it gets dirty, right? You need to segment your data. So you have a segmentation algorithm that just makes sense to you, that it gets the right sort of number of events, and then you subsequently analyze these events individually. And but you don't say, I expect 10 events. Because each event would have a particular alpha.
But what's wrong with having a lot of alphas that are predetermined and then...
We don't know. It's the unknown in this.
No, but if you can put in alphas that you want and then simply optimize by coefficients. That strikes me as a much more linear problem.
Well, but the thing is, maybe you can continue this offline, okay? So what we try to do is overlay the image in grayscale with these colored dots, which would delineate the structure. We call that seismology. Geologists call that the stratigraphy. And then the color index should tell you something about how sharp or how not sharp are the things. Is this like a jump discontinuity, or is it sharp, or is it less sharp? That's what we try to do. Now, this is difficult, but we do it for a good reason, because you have some sort of a model that tells you why you would expect to have this sort of singularities in the Earth, right? And that, if you have a model for that, then we can actually start to constrain the fine structure from core scale information. Okay, so what we can say is that we can detect at least or delineate the structure, that's called the stratigraphy. The permeabilization gives us information on the lithology, what type of stuff went on in the rocks, and geologists really want to get to that. Problems are, this is a fundamental one-dimensional method, we have to go higher dimensions, so we suffer from curvature and that sort of stuff, so we need to extend to higher dimensions. But what I haven't done yet, I want to spend the remaining 5 minutes of my talk, or six maybe, on the why do these different type of transitions exist? As I mentioned, people tend to think we have one layer and another layer and we just cement them and that's it, right? But that's, in the Earth, other things are going on. For instance, the rock consists of a mixture of two rocks, and I, as a function of the depth, I change the composition. Is there something in that process that would give rise to something that creates a singularity? Because if you have a singularity, then we reflect, right? So that's bottom line what we try to do, and I think this is speculative, but it's pretty cool, I think. And I hope it links with some of the topics of this workshop, because we'll be using ideas from percolation theory. So what really is assumed in the models that people use that link the composition of the rock, now I'm talking about volume fractions. Think of a bicompositional rock, two types of rock, A and B. What is the overall behavior of that mixture? They have basically smooth relationships between the volume fraction and the rock properties, that is the elastic ray speed, for instance. Okay, and that's and also smooth techniques are so-called homogenization or given medium theory, which is a theory that tells you how you should smooth the coefficients in a PDE. That basically smoothes out the singularities. Very unsatisfactory. If you do that, then you lose my bread and butter because I won't reflect anymore. So you want to have something that preserves the singularities, because that's where the waves reflect, and they reflect, otherwise I would not be in business. Right? So this really goes down to that it's very difficult to think in terms of effective properties for a rock when you have a mixture, when you're looking at the transport properties. So if you have the density or the porosity, they just scale volumetrically. But if you have a transport property, such as a wave speed or a permeability, then the connectivity of the rock is the most important one, right? Because you can have something where you have all material in one side, all material in the other side, and one is permeable, the other one is not, nothing will flow through. Whereas if you sort of intersperse them and you have a connected cluster, then you will flow through. So there's a geometric aspect to this, which I think is linked to the topic of this workshop. And what I'm trying to do is come up with a naive model for this. And, we have more questions than answers, but it's cool. And the reason I think it's cool, because we include connectivity in our models, which give rise to a switch. And a switch is a singularity. So what we say is this. We say, we look at mixtures of rocks, and we say at one point, the volume fraction of, say, rock B is so large that it makes a connected cluster. And when you have that connected cluster, all of a sudden the overall properties of the rock jump up, and that creates a singularity. And that's what we see. So we start with a very simple binary system, which contains of sands and shales, or a gas hydrate, not gas hydrate, whatever. And we have done this for two different type things, for elastic properties, but also for fluid flow. But these all pertain to coefficients in PDEs, right? So it's an upscaling sort of problem. So instead of doing homogeneous mixing of these two phases, where say we have a weak material and a strong material, which I will delineate with HP and LP, then if you do that, then you will only produce very gradually changing elastic properties. But let's now think in terms of a more heterogeneous that is something that's, say, random on a more macroscopic scale. So you have these macroscopic inclusions. You have a rock, A and B, volume fractions for A and B, but we're going to distribute them according to blobs randomly of material A and material B. Then we argue that there is a singularity that coincides with the fact when the stronger of the two materials becomes connected. And that sort of behavior is observed in binary alloys, but it's also observed for electric conductivity for materials. It's something that makes sense, right? Because you need to have a connected strain of highly conductive material in order to conduct, right? If there's somewhere this connection, then you won't conduct. So that's the main idea. So let me just skip this because this gets too technical.
What do these connected clusters look like?
Well, they look like, so think of it, if you think of the classical percolation problem, right? Where you have this sort of chessboard, the side percolation thing, where you have this volume fraction you can dial in. At the point that you connect, you have these fractally distributed different cluster sizes, and they have these very irregular shaped boundaries. I guess that's a Lerner equation. And what you're waiting for is the point at which you have a spanning cluster from...
And how much does reality look like that?
Well, we don't know, right? In a sense, things mix on many different length scales. What we do know, though, is that arguably very subtle changes in the composition give rise to strong reflections, and we don't understand that. And I give you an argument how we could think of this. So I really need like 2 or 3 minutes. I think I started 2 or 3 minutes late. So the idea really is that if you're in a classical theory and you look at the volume fraction versus the elastic properties, people have come up with bounds. That's any rock has to live between these two bounds. Okay. What we have now added to this model is we say if we go from a low volume fraction of, say, this is weak material and this is strong material, and you start to mix it more and more strong, then we say at one point we jump from the lower bound to the upper bound. So this is what we have added to the equation, and this point coincides to the point at which the strong material mix in connects. Because then the connected cluster will grow as an exponent, hence the overall strength of the material will go up as an exponent. That's the idea. Now, I know there's a lot you can argue with it or not, but what's interesting about this is that a lot of phenomena in nature, they have actually a gradual change in the composition, but still, if you look at the amount of sensing data from it, you get a sharp thing back. Okay, so this is the idea, the same idea where now you plot the density as a function of the volume fraction, and this would be the wave speed which creates now a singularity. Now, what's nice about this is that we can actually now do an upscaling that would preserve the singularity. So let me just walk you through a couple of plots, and I hope that will make the point. So this is, say, a synthetic way to represent the volume fraction of shale. So that's one of the two material components in a bicompositional mixture. And this is depth, and we switch between almost 100% shale to almost 0% shale. And now you would like to translate that to what sort of velocities would be associated with this. Okay, and we can do that either through a smooth equivalent medium theory or through our percolation model. And you can see that if you build in a switch, you get something that is not the same. And in particular, if you make a cross plot, you will basically see that you will create a switch because you have now a singularity in that relationship. So you can see that the blue line would be the smooth model, and this is the model where you have a switch because there's a singularity. Now, I have more material, but I think I will leave it here. What is really nice about this would give you a way to upscale the fine structure. So let me just go to the conclusions, and I see I have a little bit too many slides. Okay. So, but what is nice about this rock physical model is that you can have things that are very smoothly varying in the composition still give rise to things that are sharp as being perceived by the wave, and that reflects. Okay, so as conclusions, I know this was a lot of material, but I felt that there are lots of connections between my research program and the topic of this workshop, and I thought it would be nice to give you some overview. So first of all, I can think that the statement that using multi-scale compressible signal representations are really important if you want to get information on image waveforms. they really build robustness in the seismic imaging process, okay, at many levels. I think it's also fair to say that the image waveforms carry information on the fine structure of the reflectors. They carry information, how sharp are these reflectors? Are they really zero-order jumps, or are they something a little bit more subtle than that? And can we get that information out? I think our this detection estimation technique gets you some handle of that sort of information, and that seems to support a whole field of attribute analysis where people look at face attributes which seem to point in the same direction. The last idea is very speculative. Still, I think it has a merit of truth in the sense that now you can have a very smoothly changing composition of the rock and still yield a strong reflector, and that's what we need, because that will create a reflection, and that's where we get the way the reflected waveforms from. Thank you.